All right, take your Bible and turn to Matthew chapter 17. Matthew 17. I'm going to begin at verse number 1. And if you're following along with the church calendar the way we normally do, then you'll know that today is the last Sunday in the season after Epiphany. You'll know that it's often designated Transfiguration Sunday, which means it's a reference to a particular story. And you also know that it's the last Sunday before the season of Lent begins on Wednesday, and we'll have our regular Lent service on Wednesday at 7 in the youth room. And so if you'd like to be here for that, it's a different sort of time. If you've not been to our time we share together, it's a little more meditative, interactive. You'll probably like it because there's no preaching. Yeah? So it's always out on time, too. So probably kind of give you a little eagerness to be here for that. So Matthew 17, beginning in verse 1. And after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and his brother John and led them up on a high mountain by themselves. And he was transformed in front of them, and his face shone like the sun. Even his clothes became white as the light. Suddenly Moses and Elijah appeared to them, talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you want, I will make 3 tabernacles here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And while he, that was Peter, still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud covered them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son. I take delight in him. Listen to him." When the disciples heard it, they fell face down and were terrified. And then Jesus came up, touched them, and said, "Get up and don't be or stop being afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except him, Jesus alone. As they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, "Don't tell anyone about the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead." For me, this has been I don't know how to describe it. It's been old friend week. On Monday, I went to the state capitol to listen to education subcommittee made up of the Senate, some senators to talk about funding education. I went with another pastor, a pastor from Norman, and we were kind of interested in one particular Senate bill. And while I'm sitting there, I look up and just seated just off the main table where the chairman and the vice chairman sit and a couple of others sat Lee. Patty and I graduated with Lee. Probably seen Lee twice in 36 years. And there she was, and it went up, and I couldn't believe it. She recognized me. And we just said hi for a minute, and I said what I was there for, and she said, "You better buckle your safety belts." I don't know that if that was an allusion to the fireworks that she thought were going to go off in the discussion of that Senate bill, but nonetheless, it was kind of fun. I don't imagine that Lee ever thought that in 1981, when we graduated from Northwest Class in high school, I don't believe she probably ever thought that she would be seated just off the main focus of attention there in that Senate conference room, doing whatever her responsibilities are on the team that takes care of that particular apparatus of legislation. Probably never dreamed that she would probably run into me 36 years later in that conference room at the state capitol. Left that conference room and walk out into the hallway there, into that big rotunda, and there's James Langford. And the last time I was at the state capitol with James Langford was in the late 1990s. And he had asked me to be part of a group that went around talking to our state legislators about sex education in public schools. And so we went around and we met with a number of different senators and House members, and we were talking about that particular subject. I haven't seen James Langford in a long time, except in advertisements on television and in posts on Facebook. But it was kind of nice. He was busy. I didn't want to bother the new senator. And I just tapped him and said hello. And I hadn't got four steps. And he said, "Hey, what are you doing here?" I thought, I wondered that myself. And I imagine that when he showed up that day, he nor I imagined that we would see one another. And we hadn't seen one another in quite some time. Tuesday, I had lunch with a friend from college, Robert Kellogg. Robert was a son of a Baptist minister in Oklahoma who became a director of missions. And Robert was, he's a couple of years older than I, though I think I lucked out and graduated ahead of his six-year program. And he is now the president of the Baptist Foundation of Oklahoma. And I imagine that at no time before did he ever think that he would one day be the president of the Baptist Foundation of Oklahoma, just being a preacher's kid from whose dad last served as director of missions in the Muskogee Association in the state of Oklahoma. And I imagine I never envisioned myself sitting down at a restaurant downtown with the president of the Baptist Foundation of Oklahoma, though I knew Mr. Ross before him. And then about somewhere between 7 and 10 years ago, I think it was an out-of-the-blue email I got or an exchange on Facebook. A name popped up that I hadn't thought about with any regularity since 1985. And it was a friend of mine from college, and we kind of reconnected. See, Facebook does have some advantages. The internet is okay on occasion. And I got this email from Guy, and we kind of caught back up. And so since then, we've kind of pitched back and forth. I think we had a Skype conversation once. We've kind of kept in touch, and over those years kind of learned each other's stories. And I didn't ever imagine that until about a month ago I learned that he's going to be driving from Connecticut to California, and he'd have to go down I-40. And so whether he wanted to or not, I certainly left the imposition present. That if you're coming through Oklahoma, even if it's 2 a.m., we got to at least have coffee. Well, he got in yesterday, and we got to hang out and kind of catch up, and it's been fun. And he'll be making the rest of his cross-country jaunt later today. So I got to thinking about that, and we probably neither one of us had imagined that, you know, all these years later, him being a coastal fella, that flyover country would be a place where we would connect again outside of college. We learned what one another's doing and been doing. And along the way, I got to thinking about this particular passage. I know you wondered if this is just going to be an autobiographical sermon, and where in the world could it possibly be trailing to, and who cares about all your old friends, Todd? I get that. But I got to thinking about the way that relationships have an effect on us. They change us. They transform us. There's something about each of those relationships, and you could supply different names and different events and different durations of period where you could count up all the ways that those people who you thought may have just been a distant memory re-emerged into your living horizon, and you start thinking about all the ways they've helped you think about life, maybe experience life, maybe become a better person, maybe challenge you in all sorts of ways, to where now you could go back and say, without those relationships and without those friends, I probably wouldn't be the person that I am today. And I think that sometimes we forget that when we read the stories in the Scriptures, we just happen to think that magically God transforms us in such a way to be the kind of people that maybe we are today, completely absent of the effect of other human beings that we encounter along the way. And I happen to think that it actually is through those relationships that God happens to expose himself to us, which has been our theme for these 8 weeks in Epiphany. It, because in Jesus we believe God exposed himself to us. I know that sounds scandalous because in our culture, exposure can get you arrested. But I'm talking about opening us up to ways in which we never would have imagined or dreamed God might look like, the shape he might take, because we are ill-equipped to grasp all of that without a little bit more flesh and blood. And so why in the world would it be that God would operate in our lives any different than the way he operated in Israel's life in that first century, anticipating a Messiah finally saying, well, here he is. And certainly they, you know, didn't, their imagination wasn't particularly captured by Jesus for any number of reasons. But they had a history of thinking that they understood God in secondhand terms. And here God says, no, I want you to know who I am in real flesh and blood, real time, and real space. So I guess my thought trailed to the fact that how is it that we could ever possibly expect that any human being could encounter the love of God absent a relationship with another human being? I know that there have to be what we would call miraculous moments where people are alone, but I still would contend that anywhere along the way that someone has one of those alone moments, those aha moments, those discoveries that we refer to as an activity of the Spirit, have been laid, the groundwork's been laid through relationships that God has worked in your life and mine in ways to say, I want you to know something about me. So are you with me? So if you think about this story and you think about Peter, what comes to your mind? I mean, immediately, we tend to read the Bible this particular way. We look for all the ways we fit into the story. I mean, when you try to find yourself as a character in the Bible, have said, man, I am so like Peter. Huh? How many? That means raise your hand. I'm just taking a non-official poll. So only about two of you ever really identify with Peter. Man, the poor schlep. Now, I have a secret to tell you. I know a number of you and have for a long time, and there are some stories about Peter that often remind me of you. So if you're not willing to raise your hand because you're forgetting when you've been impulsive and you've put your foot in your mouth, when you've forgotten all those times and you think that, oh, no, I've kept it a secret and I've hidden that, and nobody really realizes all the ways that I've been like Peter, well, guess what? It's called self-awareness. And sometimes we need a dose. But the problem is sometimes when we read the text that way, what we do is we take our attention away from what's really going on in the story, and we're looking for those identifiers. How is it I could take something away? If I'm like Peter, if that's my temperament and my personality, how is it I could take something away from that? And the story then becomes all about Peter. And the story is really not about Peter, is it? Well, think back through what I read, what you saw maybe on the screen, or you had opened up on your iPad or your Kindle or your phone app if you were happened to reading along, and tell me, what is the story in Matthew 17 really about Peter? It's not a trick question. Thank you. It's not about Peter. Peter's kind of this auxiliary figure. Yes, there's an inner circle, Peter, James, and John. Yes, he's often at the forefront of some of the stories, particularly in Matthew, that get told about Jesus. But the story really isn't about Peter. Peter's kind of a secondary figure in what's taking place. But what's important is how Peter responded to his relationship with Jesus in the throes or the aftermath of this experience. And you and I wouldn't know that were it not for a little autobiographical sketch he gave us in 2 Peter chapter 1, where he is writing and in mind, he has this event in mind. And in if I can shorthand it for you without taking our time to go read that entire passage that you had as part of your reading for today, what you would discover is Peter remembered that monumental moment where something happened before him with Jesus that left an indelible mark, so much so that he was regularly reminded of his need to listen to Jesus. So that moment in relationship where he had been invited into that inner circle, and he got kind of what nine other apostles or disciples didn't get, and only two others besides him did get, that relational moment left such a mark that when he began to think about his life, because when by the time he writes, he had learned a lot about himself, learned a lot about how God was working in his life, and some of the ways in which he had been previously formed to be a particularist, or we would say today probably racist or ethnically privileging his own group of people. By the time he gets to the end of his life, before he decides that he's not worthy to be crucified in the way Jesus is, and by myth is we're told he was crucified upside down, he remembered, I should be listening to Jesus. I should be listening to Jesus. So when he recounts all the stories that he could recount, remember, Peter is a prominent figure in all the Gospels in the life of Jesus, particularly in Matthew, of all the incidental moments in relationship that Peter could have pulled out, drawn from, and relayed to a group of people who had been scattered across the Roman Empire, he pulls this one out. It shouldn't be lost on us. It's not like it's accidental or Peter didn't know what he was doing, but he was trying to remind the people who could have been listening to lots of other voices, lots of other folks who could form their lives in particular ways, and he's reminding a group of people, you know what? Listening to Jesus has been the one thing that has really altered my form of life. This is really the way I made a discovery that I never thought I would pin these words if I were Peter, that God was always aiming to have a people from every ethnic group on the planet. Prior to Acts 15, Peter, and even after that, Peter would never have uttered those words. But by the time he continues to remember to listen to Jesus, and as he's aged and by his own experience, he's reminding people, telling them, listen to Jesus. And that came in the throes of that, for him, monumental. Wouldn't you think it would have been a monumental encounter? But it was not something that he hadn't already had monumental encounters with Jesus. That he needed to listen to Jesus. And I know that it sounds awful rudimentary or oversimplified, but you know, some days you and I who claim to follow Jesus, we probably need to be reminded of this event in Peter's life, and we ought to probably stop when we're trying to listen to everyone else that forms us in a variety of ways. We probably ought to stop and listen to Jesus. Don't you find it fairly ironic that of the times that we hear a voice from the cloud from heaven, the two times we hear about that in the Gospels, it's "This is my Son, whom I love," and in the Transfiguration, "Listen to him." Now, we could just sew it up right here and say that, you know, the call of the text today that elicits a response from you and I would be to say, from here forward, when we are listening to a lot of different voices in life and as to what to do and how to treat humans and how to be different kind of people, we would commit today to listen to him. That is, listen to Jesus. And I would think we would be well done, and you would say, man, that's fantastic. That sermon is the shortest sermon you've preached in a long time. But I can't disappoint you by carrying you a little bit longer. And so I think that one thing that I wanted to draw out, kind of as a compliment to the exhortation, listen to him, would be that we're not really sure what to make of Elijah and Moses showing up. And folks have done lots of things. But I want you to kind of follow the pattern of the story, and hear the three go up. Now Jesus is he is something special to them, but he's not special to them in the way that he becomes special to them, particularly after the resurrection. Okay, is that fair enough? You with me on that? I mean, he was really a rabble-rousing sort of teacher that was always at odds with the religious structures and systems and people that represented them. And he always seemed to be in the recipient of adversarial questions. And he seemed to dispatch them all with such precision that certainly the disciples were enamored by him. But they were battling over and again about their role in that. You know, where are they going to take his place? He just gets through talking about taking up your cross and following him. And they still had really not too much of an inkling of what that would look like and how that would work. Those moments where they were trying to grapple with his absence, it's, okay, so who's going to take his place and be the greatest in Jesus' place? So Jesus wasn't spectacularly exceptional to them because they felt like they could take his place from time to time. Either that's an overestimation of themselves or an underestimation of Jesus, right? And so when he gets to this particular spot, there's the ordinary Jesus who's in ordinary ways done things that teachers don't normally do and survive, heading up a mountain. And in this moment, this metamorphosis, this Greek word that really is transformed, we've done transfigured, it's really transformed. You know, transfigured kind of has this, like maybe something, would you be like really put off if I said like, transfigured kind of creates this image like he had a third arm, an alternate leg. The word's transformed. Something was changed. And that's significant. Something about Jesus needed to be transformed in the mind of the disciples that he was not just ordinary. And he wasn't transfigured in such a way that some sort of something about his physique was changed. There's something about his presence. And so presence became an inordinately important reality for them. And here is Moses and Elijah, and we try to figure it out. Here's the law and the prophets, and what do we do with that? Because when the scene ends, they're gone. And maybe Matthew knows what he's doing is saying that, you know, these are patterns that you use to form your way of life in an attempt to be faithful to God. So you listened to the prophets and you followed the law and you were looking for a way, and it would seem to be consistent with Jesus' summary statement, I came to fulfill the law. So those two fall away, and if you want to know what it looks like to follow the challenge of the prophets and you want to follow the faithfulness in the law, what you're going to get is the life and way of Jesus. So when we sit around and try to discern, so should we or shouldn't we submit to the law, or shouldn't we listen to the prophets, it seems the answer is yes. But yes, is there summed up in Jesus? Yes, is there summed up to say that how do you think Jesus' life was formed? Anyone? He was formed in the same way he had heard the prophets growing up and he had heard the law growing up, and what shaped him and formed him was a unique obedience, faithfulness to the vision God had for all human beings. Now that's transformed, you see? Now following those, we become a different sort of person. And so no longer do I worry or wonder really, honestly, would we have ever imagined that Lee would have been in the Capitol, or Langford in the Rotunda, or Kellogg at Broadway 10, or Guy at my house. Really, the most important question is, what sort of people have we all become? What sort of people in those relationships, and having been formed listening to Jesus, what have we become? And if there's been no transformation, not transfiguration, if there's been no transformation, then I want to just simply say, without oversimplifying, because it's work, we've left off listening to Jesus. And we've been listening elsewhere. And we've decided that someone's a lot smarter than Jesus. Someone's analysis of life is better than Jesus's. Someone's illustration of what it looks like to love neighbor is better than Jesus. And so we've opted to listen to someone other than Jesus. There's some particularity about Jesus that is important. Boy, important enough for Peter to recount this moment where he remembers, if you read that first, the second Peter passage, you need to pay attention to him. I know, you always expect something really profound when the preacher gets up, right? That or you expect to not understand anything I've said, right? But it's incredibly simple here. Listen and pay attention. And then for Peter, what happens is he put that into practice. Imagine that. He put that into practice in such a way that his life was formed in ways that he, up to that point, had not imagined that they would be. So then when he sits down to write before dying, here's what I want you to know. He pulls out that bit of instruction. I'm not planning on dying. I'm not even planning on leaving. But I think of all the things that I could stand to say and declare would be to say that if that was a monumental moment that proved the formative event in Peter's life, to where he finally became the person that God had always dreamed him to be, intended or aimed for him to be, then I think that probably is simple instruction enough for us. Listen and pay attention. Because in the end of the day, it does not matter what you achieve. When you're gone, no one's really going to be impressed by all that you've done. But they will remember the kind of person you and I were. And if there's any possible way you and I could have any impact in the world where we could lay claims that there is a God and he loves in particular ways, it will be when the kind of people that you and I are remembered for the way that we have loved and cared for those around us. You know, we've had Tripp out a few times, and he's got this benediction that he offers about every time he preaches. We just don't let him do the benediction. Our mistake. But he's summed it up like this. You know, what we aim to do in our living is to make sure that we are communicating or expressing the fact that God knows your name, knows your face, and he cares. He knows your name and he knows your face and he cares. And that only happens in relationship. And while it may be augmented by occasions of catching up on Facebook and sharing time in email, it is never solidified quite like being able to shake a hand or hug a neck or hold out a hand with something that you have that someone needs, and you do it not grudgingly but in love. Those are the moments that become transformative. And listen, they become transformative for you and me. You see, most of the time we practice our pieties for the good of somebody else. I think that's why Jesus said in Matthew 6, don't practice your pieties before people. Because those pieties are to be practiced in such a way that they form you and me. So if our rendering aid to someone in need in any form or fashion, we think in our mind it's for them, then we probably ought to stop practicing our pieties. It is the way it shapes you and me. Certainly the benefit is the help and the expression of love that comes. But if you're not practicing a way that forms you to be different, well, you won't be different. So here's what we say. Peter said in that little letter, "This is my son. I'm delighted in him. Listen to him and pay attention."